Hi, I'm Jessica Ekoman, and I'm a sound artist and musician. I'm an electronic musician. I do sound installation, but mostly these days music, live performances in quadraphonic sound. And I released an album last year on Important Records that was called Multivocal.
Hi, my name's Annie Go. I'm an artist and a researcher. I guess I'm also a sound artist, but I guess my practice has taken on different turns, but I still am very much rooted in sound and technology, generative processes, and teaching sound arts and fine arts at the University of Arts London. You're listening to Mutant Promise on the Somerset House Studios podcast. It's so great to see you, Jessica. I was looking forward to this conversation. It's been a kind of stressful few weeks. Really lovely to see you. How are you?
Exactly. Long time no see. It was also stressful for everybody, I guess. I think we're all involved in this in a different ways, maybe. But it's also, it carries a lot of hope, you know, what is going on now. Maybe there's hope for change, etc. So it's kind of complex feelings. I don't know, what was your experience on your side?
So my experience of this has mainly been within my job, teaching and conversations with students and colleagues, particularly around addressing racism at university. So it's been a heavy time, but as you say, there's also a lot of occasion for forward thinking and hope, and using the energies aroused for positive changes. So
indeed, it has been quite painful. It reopens a lot of your own personal experiences that you had with this, family experiences, etc. So, but yeah, when I say it carries hopes, I feel like for me, at least, it has been a way to kind of process this as well, like to follow what is going on, try to imagine how I can participate in this, and also learn from this. I'm really happy that there's this conversation going on, because even though it reopens wounds, I think it's time to deal with this. I have hopes, but I hope that it's not, those hopes are not going to be disappointed at the end. Because we never know how things change, no? Because change is not the same as, it's not necessarily positive or negative, it's just change, no? So we don't know yet in which direction it's going to go. Let's see. But it's really, quite complex.
I suppose it was really great to see you in London recently, just to see how you developed as an artist and as a musician. So we both studied sound studies at the University of Arts Berlin. You studied it, I think, slightly after me, because I began in 2008. When did you start?
I think I must have started, I don't know, maybe 3 years after you or something like this. And actually, it's also a bit thanks to you that I got into this program, no? Because it's through you that I knew about it. And you kind of helped me with the application, etc. So this is a public thanks to you.
I actually don't remember that. How did I meet you otherwise? I thought I maybe met you through sound studies. No, I knew you before that.
Yeah, because I was going around, I guess, in the class of Alberto De Campo, the generative art class at the UDK as well. And I was kind of taking classes here and there, trying to see what can be interesting for me, or what's going to the direction that I'm interested in with electronic music, technology, sound, etc.
So we share that. We share that experience of studying, I guess, in Berlin at the University of Arts in those two programs, which also kind of bridge our practices, both the sound side and the computational side. What was it like for you studying those degrees?
So I think what I remember from these studies, actually, and what I think is the most important when you study, actually, is the people you meet there. So in this sense, it was really important. And I think it's like really focusing on this and being in an environment that is more let's say, being submerged into such an environment and thinking about sound almost 24 hours like that and talking about it, etc., exchanging about it, allowed me to kind of find myself and find my own voice in there. Because I think I had some ideas before, but having ideas and realizing things, actually making them, there's a little bit of a gap there. So for me, it's really the moment where of finding my voice, I would say, in terms of practice. And also finding a sort of independence as well, because I was saying that for me in studying, what's more important is the people you meet, and understanding also what you can get for yourself from there, and being independent in there. Because I already studied in the past, I studied art history in France, but it felt much more forced. I was younger, etc. So this was a second kind of life, so to say. Yeah. What was it for you?
I guess similarly to you, I had done a like non-practice based degree, and for me, doing sound studies was the first time that I was developing a practice, and also was really keen to bring theory and practice together, which is why I kind of chose that degree program, and used it similar to you as an opportunity to really kind of get to grips with sound and different approaches to sound. And I'd also agree that the experience was much more shaped by the people that I met and engaged with, and rather than, like, the degree program was really new at the time, and I think it had quite a lot of problems looking back on it now. Yeah, so that was my experience. Also, being one of very few women studying the course, I was young at the time, in my early 20s, and being the only non-white person, I'm really trying to think now, but there was very few non-white male staff, if any, when I was studying there, so that's something that I guess has really influenced the themes that I've been addressing in my work ever since then. So issues of gender and race in audio technology, electronic music, and related fields. What was the representation like in your cohort when you studied sound studies?
I think half of the class was non-German, and women, we were not so many women. I think, how many? Maybe 4 or 5 or something like this. But then I changed, also I moved to another year afterward. But when I started, it was like this, and I was the only non-white person also. But this is also a situation that I've often been into in my life also. I mean, I was kind of prepared that those spaces are predominantly white. At the time, it was much more like this than now, I think. Because also in Berlin, in all the places where I was going, it was also not so mixed as well, I think. And I think this was really the fact that it was predominantly white male really influenced the dynamic of the group also. It was also predominantly German, so of course, and at the time the course was in German, which makes sense, but then this is why also some people were talking more. But it influenced the dynamic of the group in the sense that I think there is, at least from my personal observation, there is something going on in terms of identity in the way of some men are using technology as if it was kind of validating their masculinity or something like this. And this, I really realized it there. And a moment that was really a tipping point for me was also when I started to, because I didn't know so much about all this before. And at first I assumed I had less knowledge, but then with the time I studied a lot, etc., and I started to kind of catch up with the level. And then I kind of could see through the rhetoric or what's around the language, and I could understand what they are talking about. And then I saw that actually some people were not saying something that is really exact, actually, but it's really more about the way it's said that embodies this identity and this kind of power. And this was really important for me to realize.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's also really important to think about class and obviously the intersections it has with gender and race and ability and other things too that aren't often talked about, but it all kind of constitutes a certain kind of unspoken atmosphere about the rules of a space, which is really pervasive, especially in educational spaces, where it's so easy to for some of us, let's see, to feel at like outsiders and to feel that many of the experiences we might have had might not be of interest. But I think things are changing. And it's funny reflecting on these educational experiences now as a teacher and as someone who gets to design, you know, curricula and teach sound arts, and that has really influenced me. So this, I do something at LCC called the Sound Arts Visiting Practitioner Lecture Series, and underpinning that is a whole kind of critique of the canon of sound arts as it was taught to me. And so it's been predominantly women and non-binary people, Black and Asian and other ethnic minorities. I've really just tried to incorporate as diverse voices as possible, but not in a tokenistic way, as often happens, but also generally because I think these are really brilliant and fascinating practices that I want my students to know about, and I want them to be expansive in their explorations of what sound arts is. And I always ask this question, like, what do you think sound arts is, to the visiting guests? And yeah, just to keep that an ongoing question, I think, rather than this is what sound arts is and these people did that in the 70s and 80s.
And I think this is important, rightly, as you said, not only about tokenism or something like this, but because, for example, the way I was introduced also to the history of sound art, it always go through, like, you know, John Cage, etc. I mean, there's this idea of, like, modernity that just go one way and that is located in certain places in the world. And I find that, I mean, yeah, it's really not true. And I also noticed this, especially after having this background and traveling. For example, when I was in Indonesia and I was talking with one composer that is doing gamelan and has his own gamelan ensemble with his own tuning. And then we were talking about sound, and then he said, like, in one of his recordings, he has the recording of the environment in there, because also for a long time the way you were listening to gamelan music was in the outside, so the sound from outside belongs to the music in a way. And so this is, if you think that this tradition has been there for a long time, then John Cage has done nothing new except bringing it in the concert place, you know what I mean, or in a really institutionalized, formalized, recognized place for people with the power. So it's interesting to think about sound from this perspective as well.
Maybe it's good to talk about technology as we talk about sound art too. As you work in Max, with Max MSP, maybe you want to talk a bit about how that came about and why you gravitated towards it. What's your kind of setup right now? Is it just Max, or do you have like a few different things that are your favorites?
Right now, when I play live, it's only Max. And I got around to use it through Sound Studies also, because we were doing this project with wave field synthesis. By the way, this course was by Robert Tenker. And also, I just wanted to quickly go back to what I said before, because I mentioned this composer, and his name is Dewalit. I should say his name as well. It's important. So to come back to this course with Robert Enke, so we had to, I mean, he did this interface to communicate with wave field synthesis, and he did this, and then he kind of built an interface inside Max that would make it easier for us to use Max, and he showed a few objects, and then he said, okay, you have 1 month. See you in 1 month at CTM, we're going to show this stuff. And at that point, I never used it. But I think the fact to have this deadline and to be forced to do this, I mean, at first I thought, okay, I will never do that, and this is something too complicated for me, maybe like using this programming languages, so you have to be kind of an engineer, etc. But I was kind of forced to go over my fear and spend a lot of time with them. And I think at that point, this is where I realized at some point, oh, I understand how this works, and actually the logic of it is really interesting for me. Because wave field synthesis works with space as well, so you are programming the sound in the space. And I think this was a starting point also for me to integrate this dimension in composition. And there's probably, I mean, also the fact that I was doing sound installation, but from both of these angles, then I think this is why now I'm playing, I mean, this has influenced the decision that I took to play in quadraphonic sound. I think when you compose directly, for example, if I would have a piano and just play a melody or something like this, I would play something that is really maybe more, what is the word for this? Formatted, maybe, than I would like. Sometimes I don't necessarily realize. So I think this tool also allowed me to, explore my own formatting and trying to break it, so to say.
It was great to hear you talk about that, actually, how you got into using Max, because I didn't know that. Also, it reminded me of when I studied science studies, and everyone was banging on about wave field synthesis nonstop, and I didn't know what it was for ages. And it's like imprinted, like Wellenfeld synthesis. It was talked about so often every day. So I'd forgotten about that. So thanks for the reminder. But I think, it does kind of show how influenced you are by your teachers as well, because you had Robert Henke because you studied later than me, but I didn't actually get taught by him. So I kind of wasn't really initiated. So I was kind of doing the thing with the digital audio workstations and learning all of that myself, and doing installations and other things, but I didn't actually get direct exposure. I knew what Max MSP was, and we did a bit of Pure Data, which is a similar program, similar kind of graphical interface program. But for me, I had a kind of similar moment to what you described as having a bit of a, not exactly epiphany, that's probably exaggerating it, but an eye-opening moment to how to work with sound when I studied with Alberto de Campo and got to know SuperCollider in the generative computational art class at the University of Arts Berlin. And that was actually, it's kind of a different experience because it was such a painful and long process to even be able to make a sound with SuperCollider, because SuperCollider is a platform which is in written in code, right? So it's a synthesis, sound synthesis program, and a language and a sound server, probably not doing it justice. The nerds will probably kind of come up on me of how to actually describe it. But anyway, but the fact that it was written in code and you had to learn this programming language in order to synthesize sounds absolutely fascinated me, but also made it a really long, a steep learning curve. So I couldn't really get straight to it, but I was like very kind of taken by the idea of being able to synthesize potentially any sound from scratch and building it up and having this kind of very micro approach to making sounds. But that was also kind of quite, as I said, painful, because there was so much that could go wrong and I was constantly like wanting to build things, but it was very frustrated by, not putting not closing the bracket, or, not really knowing how to plug these things together.
And since you know both SuperCollider and Pure Data and Max MSP, I mean, do you have the impression that it changes something also in the way you approach sound of music if you using either of those?
Yeah, I think it does. I'm probably not in a position to speak in any expert way, because I never really got to grips with Max or Pure Data. I just dabbled. But I think it definitely does influence the way that you almost like conceptualize the sounds and what you're doing with them. So in SuperGlider, you have to build your own like graphical user interfaces, your own boxes and buttons and sliders and stuff on the screen, which is not dissimilar to Max, I suppose, but it's all underpinned by the code. So the code is more central somehow, and it's less like visually connected. So it's still something I struggle with massively, and it's not something like I want to unwind and sit and code some sounds. Like, it's still like quite a struggle, an undertaking for me. Maybe it's a good time to talk about your latest release, Multivocal, and how that came about, the ideas that influenced that.
So first it was, I've been asked by the artist Julie Cheng. She's a video artist, and she represented Taiwan at the last Venice Biennale. And so she's doing this event every year in Linz, that is called in a place that is called Steigwerstadt. And it happened during Ars Electronica, so it's connected to, it belongs to Ars Electronica. And so the theme of her night was sleep. So it was an event that was going on the whole night. And people could sleep there, etc. And she asked different artists to play for 2 hours. And so this is how I came about to think about this idea of sleep or alternate state of consciousness in this way. And this is why I was interested to explore this kind of generative, long durational type of format. So it's a little bit, at the time I thought a little bit about it between, let's say, music and installation in a way. I mean, because it wasn't really about me being on stage, and it wasn't really about listening to or waiting for the next musical event, because you kind of know what is going to happen. But then you also don't know, because it seems always the same, but in fact it's always changing. So, for example, at the time some people were also leaving the room, going somewhere else, etc. But if you come back, the music sounds totally different. In the context of sleep, then what was interesting for me is that also at some point, because it's so repetitive and you kind of think you know what's going to happen, then you don't hold your attention so much anymore on the music. I mean, something else happened, or your perception of the music is changing. So this was kind of some of the idea behind this project.
Oh, well, I've got to say, I love the release from what I've heard of it. And I didn't know that it was so connected to kind of sleep and this whole project at Ars Electronica, but I know I've been there, so I know the building that you, I guess, played in. But that's fascinating that it was that context, and I guess also context which was pushing back against the idea of the audience like paying full attention to the musicians on stage, if it was a kind of open situation with people floating in and out.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, I think, this is why it was a bit challenging to imagine how I could make a record out of it. Actually, I've done some, like, 2 other pieces, but then I didn't include it in there. But I think, I mean, the final record is not necessarily about sleep, but, yeah, maybe about just, like, holding and releasing consciousness, maybe, or, you know, like, there's this kind of psychedelic aspect, maybe, that happens there. And also it's interesting to see that even though it's the same process happening at slightly different speeds, the sound changes a lot in your perception of what's going on. So it sounds like totally 2 different pieces, even though it's sort of the same, but it's just dressed in different clothes, so to say.
Yeah, I love how it's got that. It's kind of sounds, when you're listening to it, it kind of feels like you're looking at a like an optical illusion. And that's not a very good explanation of it, but there's this kind of weird shifting sense of like your kind of perception being played with through the very minute shifts in the sounds as it repeats and develops. Maybe I'm influenced by the cover, which is, yeah, kind of an optical illusion, right?
Yes, it's like the vibrating colors. And actually, yeah, if you see it under a certain light, it really seems like the blue is like kind of floating, or it's like some really strange stuff happen in your eye. Really interesting. It's also really changing depending on the lighting, and so I like this aspect that the cover kind of reflects the content.
And what's next for you? Have you got other releases planned? Are you doing more live stuff?
Yeah, I mean, let's see of what the conditions will be for us now for traveling, etc. I think I cannot go into exactly in detail on different projects because it also depends, like some of them I'm not totally sure. But there are different commissions for acoustic instruments, actually, like two different ones that you can expect to hear about. So this is really interesting for me, and this is something I wanted to try since a long time, because actually, like, I'm not really trained classically in composing. So, for example, I would not be able to think a composition and then write directly on a sheet of music. But then the technology that I use really allows me to compose. And I'm really looking forward to see how from there I can translate it to make acoustic instrument play it and have this kind of technologically assist composition process and this feedback with the computer and how it translates to, I mean, this would be actually some more like really old traditional instruments probably. And what is for you? What are you working on, by the way?
So the Sonic Cyber Feminisms project that I've been doing for the past few years with my friend Marie Thompson is, like, when I said before that my practice has kind of transformed, and it's almost like transformed into a more social practice. So there's kind of more academic parts of that project, Sonic Cyberfeminism. So Marie and I are also co-editing a journal special issue, which links together the broad thematics of cyberfeminism, but tries to also rethink those discourses as they were in the 90s. So cyberfeminism as a kind of very loose set of events that happened in the 90s, which was a feminist critique of technology. And bringing that together with thematics of sound and audio. So it's kind of like, yeah, taken on all these nebulous forms. And as part of that project, I was working on my own computer music project and have been for several years now, and has got sidelined by my PhD and then now my teaching jobs. But I was due to revive that recently, and I'd been invited to go to Portugal and give a kind of lecture on sonic materiality and a performance, and I was really looking forward to doing so and finding, you know, forcing myself to have the time to apply myself to my sound practice again, but unfortunately that never happened. But that's, I think, the cyberfeminist, I called it Gendy Trouble, cyberfeminist computer music project that I started probably around 2014, but never really nailed. So I had all these different episodes, I did a few performances, but it just kind of unfortunately got drowned out with other things. So I'm always living in hope that I will find the time to apply myself to it.
But I wanted to say, yeah, I like that you use this word social practice to frame one of the things you're doing. It kind of resonated in me because actually some of the other things they're doing, I mean, more now because of the current conditions, but then I've been teaching a bit more, giving more workshop or talks, etc. And I realized that this could totally make sense with my artistic practice in some way. It's really bringing a lot. It's also similar to, because I also have this radio show on Kashmir Radio, no? And I feel like I'm mostly inviting people to take over, to have kind of this kind of centralized way of doing. And I feel like, but still I'm having a lot of conversation with them, and I feel like through all these conversations also with people that I give workshops to, etc., I'm getting a lot of insights into yeah, just dynamics between people, maybe, which is something I've always been interested by. So experimenting with different dynamics in the group, etc. But also I found or I understood now also that maybe it was some sort of there's some kind of political side there also, like in trying to see all the sort of dynamic that you would like to have, or the sort of system you would like to have, if you can experiment on a small level like that, if it works, and really kind of feel it with your body, you know, not only talk about it in theory and reading, etc. This was really informative somehow. And like trying to think about how to teach, and also because I don't really like, this maybe comes from my background from studying in France, but in France it's really hierarchical between the, or it was at the time between the, at university, between the teacher and the students. You were really like treated in a really bad way sometimes, or like almost abused in a way. And I really don't like this, because also for me it says something about the society as a whole. And so even though in the workshop I've been giving, it was mostly lecture-like, etc., I'm starting to enjoy also having conversation with students and understand what people are out around me that are not necessarily in the usual small society circle I'm in. This was really refreshing, having different perspective in this way.
Yeah, I wanted to ask actually about your experiences as a teacher now, kind of from the educational experiences that we discussed towards the beginning of our conversation. Yeah, I think this idea of like an open approach to what constitutes a sonic practice is something that I try and pursue kind of as a pedagogue, as an educator. Partly because I think it's a bit of a problem that often in musical, sound arts, artistic discourses, because of this almost like presumed autonomy of the art object, like the whole sociality and the social connections surrounding the production of an art object get ignored. So I think radio and what you described really speaks to that, because you can't ignore the people and the kind of politics that gets brought into these spaces. And I think if anything, those are massive parts of it. And there's still a very pervasive idea in like this very serious kind of serious electronic music or serious sound arts kind of circles that, that, you know, politics and like social issues and cultural issues are somehow out there rather than within the very substance of everything. So I want to work more with radio actually, also because I think it rids you of, I mean, I think it makes you work with time really differently, in a way that we perhaps as people who work with sound are used to having a lot of, almost like you get the microscope and you work again and again on a small piece of audio until you're like pleased with it, whereas you have to let go a lot more with radio and just let it be. Use that time, do something with that time, and then come back next week and do another 2-hour slot or something.
Yes, definitely. No, I mean, it totally resonates with me what you said about the context, because it's something that I used to be always upset with, starting with when I studied art history, that there is this kind of modernist movement in art or something like this, where the white cube started to be the standard. And what became a standard, actually, we realized it was not neutral at all. It was all the contrary, you know. And I was always kind of bothered by it. And I think there's maybe a side of the way also sound art was taught that was kind of on this model. Also, like sound as just a sort of scientific phenomena, sound as such, you know. For me, this doesn't say anything. I can't see it like this. It's already a perspective somehow, but it's not neutral. So I think it's really important to talk about that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any more comments about what it's like to be as a teacher? Like you were saying that you disagree with the hierarchical way that you were often taught. So what's it like now that you're giving classes?
Well, there's always, I think I'm just at the beginning. I need to do it more. And also now I've done it just a few times online, so I think it's something you need to adjust to as well. This format is totally different than if you're sharing the space with other people, and then you can go on a break together, eat something together, talk to the people one by one. So I thought that for at least the first workshop that we did now with Somerset, our studios for Mutant Promise, that maybe because we were forced to have this online format, then it would be good to hold some space for the people that would not necessarily directly get access to this information, because I was expecting that probably would be a lot of people from London that would directly take the places. And this is why we all did some space for... I have some friends in Cairo, and also through Nyege, we got some people in Uganda, etc. And I thought that actually if we are forced to do this, the best is to use it as a way to reach people that usually maybe not necessarily wouldn't come, but also there's this visa aspect in there that is becoming problematic there, etc. And then when you go to this, when you're forced to go on this format, then it kind of puts everybody together in a way that I found was interesting. If it's possible, I always try to have a conversation. I mean, there's always a moment where if I teach Max, for example, you need to explain the basics, no? So everybody is on the same level. So there's always this moment where I'm going to talk frontally, and it's going to be just one way. But then if we have more time, then you can move to more workshop type of things, and everybody work on the idea. And if they have already experience as a musician, then everybody has their own perspective. So for me, what's interesting there is also to see, because I try to not show my own patches and my own music, because I know if you don't know the software, then you're gonna try to do this, I think, or it's really important what you get shown first. And so for me, it's really interesting to see what people will do with their own perspective and with the same tool as I use. This is somehow really inspiring. To see how some people find solutions I would never have thought about, etc. And then this become more of an exchange then, you know, like once I transmitted, shared this part of my knowledge, but what I know, then maybe someone else can teach me that, or through conversation, you know, making me reconsider my perspective on thing, etc. In base case, this is, exactly, this is what I learned from that.
That's really nice, like that you always learn from your students. And I think like the situation that you described is like a really nice way of demonstrating that is genuinely true, that like kind of being disciplined into doing something a certain way is how kind of classical music is taught, and then it is about perfecting techniques. And I think it would feel a little odd to go about teaching Max MSP, I think, in that way, given, you know, the wide expanses that it enables. So it sounds like a good approach as a teacher.
Yeah, I mean, also because at the time when I started to learn these tools and I was seeing all it was taught, sometimes it was really uninspiring for me. So it also totally comes from my personal experience as well. It didn't make sense for me to... I wanted directly to try to see what I can do with it and not learn the right, supposedly right way of doing things and taking ages until I can do my own music. Yeah.
Somerset House, studios.